Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Okay, this is a catch-up podcast. Now means that with the podcast machine away in my pocket, and I must have switched it off halfway through. So I don't know how much of that LED stuff that I described to you works. So I'm not going to go over it again, but however, basically LEDs are shaped gates, and they're changing shape emits light coming from. I might do a bit of history of LED at some point, light emitting diode. But for the moment, as I'm going up here, I'm going to recite the periodic table. I'm sorry, mate, to get across. So just going up this hill, I just need to have something that I can do without. Oh, I suppose it is thinking hydrogen, helium, lithium. This wind is blowing at the moment because it's down this gully. And I shudder to think what it sounds like. I'll eventually improve it. So, hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon, sodium, magnesium, aluminium, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, argon, potassium, calcium, scandium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese, iron, cobalt, nickel, copper, zinc, gallium, germanium, arsenic, selenium, bromine, krypton, iridium, strontium, yttrium, zirconium, niobium, lithium, technetium, ruthenium, rhenium, ruthenium, rhodium, palladium, silver, cadmium, indium, tin, antimony, tellurium, iodine, xenon, cesium, barium, lanthanum, cerium, praseodymium, neodymium, promethium, samarium, european goldium, terbium, dysprosium, holmium, erbium, thulmium, yttrium, chysium, hafnium, tantalum, tungsten, rhenium, osmium, iridium, platinum, gold, mercury, thallium, lead, bismuth, plutonium, astinium, radon, francium, radium, actinium, thorium, protactinium, uranium, neptunium, plutonium, americium, curium, Berkeley, californium, fermium, Einstein, merylis, and nobelium. Lawrencium, rutherfordium, dubnium, seaborgium, borium, hafnium, yttrium, deuterium, ruthenium, holmium, nipponium, fluvium, muscovium, livermorium, tennesseum, and orgasium. Thanks a lot for listening. Don't know how much I did that. Recollections of a community observatory, which is just behind my house, basically, sort of in a block behind my house, in South Australia. So I was in South Australia probably 65 to 75, 10 years, probably less than that when I was growing up. So I would have been, 6 years old. All of this stuff is before I went to school. Oh, I think I was probably at school, so probably older. Look, South Australia back in the 70s was a different place. Being a kid was a different thing. And so, much to everyone's surprise, we kids could just walk out, go up the creek, picked up friends' places without necessarily telling your mum. There's always a roast for lunch on Sunday, and afterwards I would just go out for a walk. I'd probably visit, go up and visit kids, and so it was a free world which you just can't imagine now. There were no mobile phones, and it was sort of a different place. And as a kid, you would talk to a lot of strangers, strange people. Now, of course, this doesn't turn out well for the one in a million people, but majority of people, that led to a different type of relationship. So I'm very much aware of my kids being, my own children now being afraid of strangers and not knowing how to start up a conversation. And there's sort of this, I think, and this is the difference between a country town. So Adelaide is pretty much a country town, and so Adelaide, it's in South Australia, sort of the centre of Australia, down the south. There's sort of Australia, it's got this bite taken out of it, and just on the right-hand cheek of that bite is a little toe of land, and inside that toe of land, on the sort of the side of that bulge down there, you have this bulge. You've got Adelaide, and then 800 kilometres across is to Melbourne, and 800 kilometres further up, 850 is 900 is Sydney. So Adelaide's there, sort of, and Adelaide's very much at the mouth of the Murray. So the Murray, the river slows down, and land around the Murray is totally infested with mosquitoes, really unlivable for a place. So Adelaide's a bit further up, where it begins to be a bit desert-like and dry. Adelaide's a very dry place. There's always has had, well, when I was there, there's not water restrictions, but the water, you wouldn't have a cup of water, there would be sediment at the bottom of the there. You know, people would drink from rain tanks. If you had a bath, you had in the bath, there would be dirt at the bottom of the bath on the water, and the waters are very hard. There always used to be tanks at the back for cleaning the water. And back in the day, you'd get on your bike, or in this case, my trike there, and in the evening, you'd be allowed to go out in the evening at night, this stuff as well. And you're supposed to be in bed and all that type of stuff, but if you're awake, you're still allowed to go out. And in the sports field, so there's Marrickville, which is this is really about 2 kilometres from the heart of Adelaide. So, really, Adelaide's a central housing development, which is the centre of the city, and then there's going to be housing development. Then that's Ringgriff Parklands. And then they had the idea of having some suburbs up above. And so really you can pretty well walk. You know, nowadays it would be an easy walk. But then it was an inconceivable distance into the city. It was always a complex bus ride to drive in. So in this suburb there is Marrickville, Norwood, and Marrickville High, which I think would now be a microscopic high school, state school. And in on the oval off the side was a small shed with a dome in it, and that was the observatory. And this shed basically sort of headroom inside it at night, there'd be a little red light, and inside it would be an orrery, which you gained. Got to look at the little brass things. An orrery is a mechanical solar system, you know, to turn that and move around. And eventually the astronomy people will be there, I think every Friday night. Now this is the, things have changed now. Nowadays you have to register everyone in. Insurance, have the people running at child protection, and you know, all these steps much safer, and time, and there'd be video and power, as it was, I think it was just enough power there, and there was a single telescope there, and people would look up over it. And essentially in the 70s there were all the so South Australia had a large German community, and there were all and heaps of people were ex-World War II. So various of my teachers were World War II fighter pilots, or mosquito pilots and things like that, going across. And there's a hospital, a repatriation hospital, with the World War I veterans still suffering gas and stuff like that. But there are also the German, well, I say this because the astronomy people would be German, and they occasionally speak to each other a little bit in German, and sometimes it would be cold, and the dome would be really sticking, because I think the, what was the dome mechanized? They had little motors to move things around to keep it tracked. But this is before digital stuff and stuff like that. And I do remember that there was an art to putting the little switch, the brass switch, the motor on its side. It worked that way. Didn't work the other way. But the I remember the people saying, "Oh, this reminds me of the old tanks. You know, oh, it'd be cold in winter and stuff like that." And oh, my brother remembered it. It's only years later I thought, oh, perhaps not their brother, but the person themselves. They're pretty old guys there, and they used to basically point up a few star systems. I learnt a few star systems. I remember being incredibly annoying, because occasionally, if you can imagine being, so I used to be allowed to go up with my trike, no knees, where you're up at the observatory with the people there. I don't think my parents ever went there. And yeah, I think I was there by myself, but they would describe space and stuff like that, and they point at Alpha Centauri and you see two points, and Sirius, the brightest star, and a few constellations, and I think the jewel box you see. And of course back then South Australia, sort of like nothing, you know, the world's become much brighter, lighter space. And so I remember the old Holden cars, the headlights weren't as bright, and I do remember that my bike had well, as I talk about it, there's this eerie light coming here, coming down. Here, of course, Adelaide had excellent viewing, very dry stuff. You occasionally would look at the moon, but I would I remember this couple of, "Oh, let's look at all the," and he would say, "Oh, look at this Alpha Centauri." I said, "Oh, you said that last time." I laughed, and I didn't really mean to be upsetting. And I sort of do. That's a truck and a half going down. It's got its roo lights on the top. That's so what what it used to be. Still people have the spotlights, but they have these pretty high row of bright LED lights to really shine up against kangaroos. You don't have, I shudder to think, I don't think there'd be anyone who's hit a kangaroo around here. It's the sort of country roads at night doing. They would describe, so there'd be a limited amount of knowledge. And I suppose thinking back about it, I used to ask these questions. I remember they used to ask me, they'd say, what sort of music do you like? Hey. Yeah, mate. Oh, that's a bit of shock. I don't know, and it's fairly clear at night, but there's this rain falling from the trees. I don't know how that happens. You can actually be in the middle of the Australian bush, right? And there's constant rain, and it's shit from all the insects just dropping down, or eggs. You know, basically, if there's a plague of gum leaf insects, you know, big stick insects eating there, you just hear this continuous rain throughout the night, and you say if you're a little tent, you'll get a little pile, little poo. Poo in there. So, people there, I remember them asking, and, did I like, you know, classical music, or, and could I, they asked some really simple things like, Beethoven's Symphony and Ninth Symphony and a bit of stuff like that. And I used to ask them, you know, basically, what is a star, and where does the energy come from? You know, why is it hot? And sort of got a bit of an answer for it there, but that was something. So I definitely knew the value of having scientific hardware sitting available in the community as a community resource. And I think at the moment, people, that concept has gone by the wayside. Occasionally there's government money for it, but I remember having been inspired by that to say, well, I know something which does work. Why don't we buy a local school with government money, an observatory? Well, you should have seen people say, well, how do you know it works? I'm sure this is that. Ah, so it was there, yeah. I don't know what that was. I'm sure that was the truck that went down with the roo lights on. So, that's it. How do you know it works? And people just, I got the local astronomers to go through and talk with the people, community on site, but the teachers and stuff like that really dug their heels and said, no, we want air conditioning and carpets instead, even though the grant was for technology. But, you know, there was a fraction and a reading of it, and it's a bit of a solitary lesson. Here in that people need things in a box and they need what we really need is a mobile van, an astronomy van with a telescope in it, such that it comes out and sort of expands as a pod. So you've got the basic dome there, but the actual room and space in it expands outwards. Sort of like a caravan or something like that. And possibly a laser pointing Yeah, so that's... for me, I find it very, very complex to understand why we have so much wealth, so much possibility, yet people spend a lot of their time shutting things down. Their day's work, of their productive life, is spending a lot of time putting obstacles in front of things. So I find that sort of breathtaking, so to speak, especially because Australia coming up has been such massive steps of, not everyone, but massive steps of getting out there, building things, taking risks, poor Aboriginals, but in this sort of stuff, that has given way to people blocking things. It's interesting in that you almost get the harm of a very well-run family where the next generation of kids just muck up the inheritance in that they're all jealousy and they have got an inheritance mindset that there's this wealth, there's schools and stuff like that, and they have conveyed the money, this sense of entitlement to work it, and in that thing you are very much your power is through your favour. I grant you favour to do it. So unfortunately, when I wanted to expand it, it wasn't possible. However, that being said, there might be a way to create an international base. I think it's the if you listen to the story of how these things evolved, you've got little evolving evolution, it may be that we can learn and produce a new paradigm where it's just not some ex-Germans in the back of a high school. The world has changed and we can't. The pathway is not there anymore. However, there may be, in this interconnected age, an interest to get there in a different way. I'm thinking of the what's called the Citizen Science Project at Donald Park to get going. Okay, thanks a lot for listening, and I'll keep going.
Continuing on episode 4 of Tasmanian Devil, halfway through, but we'll add this to the podcast. For all her apparent direct association with devils, many of her descriptions are clearly inaccurate. And it's of interest that the drawing of the animals accompanying Meredith's text is a freehand copy of Gould's originals, unattributed and minus the background devils. She, or another, likewise copied the famous Gould lithograph of the thylacine pair. This is the Tasmanian tiger, an animal admittedly much harder to locate, let alone sketch. Louisa Ann Meredith died in 1895. In that year, wealthy Hobart solitaire Mary Roberts opened a private zoo at Balmoris House close to the town. The contrast between the women is stark. Not only did Mary Roberts like devils, she bred them, and in doing so, helped shift the image from a diabolical satanic to merely an animal. Roberts achieved international fame for her devotion to the animal causes through activities such as her founding of the Anti-Plumage League. Wow, is that weird? The Anti-Plumage League. But she also had a highly developed business sense, importing wildlife from all over the world while exporting whatever Tasmania fauna she could. Not unlike George Harris, almost a century earlier, in 1915, Mary Roberts wrote about the devil for academic British audience. This time, the London Zoological Society. It's an important, accurate document, given the lack of written information about the devil then and the universal ignorance of it. The article is titled, Keeping and Breeding the Tasmanian Devils. What I would like to say is that this is the European view, so it's really interesting. Here's a quote from it. Until I was asked by Mr. A.E. Cerf, director of the Zoological Gardens, Moore Park, New South Wales, early in 1910 to obtain, if possible, Tasmanian tigers, thylacines, and devils for London Zoological Society, I never thought of keeping either animals in my collection. In fact, they are quite unknown to me except at the museum specimens. Although I had frequently visited the more remote parts of the island, I had vivid recollections, however, of how, when a young girl at a boarding school in the late 1840s, some of the girls from Bothwell near the Lake District used to give me graphic and terrifying accounts of the Tasmanian devils with their double rows of teeth. This belief is not yet exploded, as it was impressed upon me lately with an utmost confidence by a country visitor that such was the case. He not only believed, but he had seen the teeth have been described to me by scientists as truncated. Shortly after hearing from Mr. Leslie by means of advertising, writing, etc., I obtained three for the London Society, and having then become thoroughly interested, I determined to keep one myself. Since at that time, a large number have passed through my hands, and more than once I have been a woman possessed of seven devils. In April 1911, I received a family, a mother and four young, and again in September for the same year, a similar lot arrived. The former were very young, and I had the opportunity of watching their growth almost from the first appearance, when partly protruding from the pouch. When sending them, the trapper wrote, "The mother is so quiet, I need not be afraid to pick her up in my arms. The little ones hung from her pouch, heads hidden in it, and she lay still and motionless as if afraid of hurting them by moving, and allowed me to stroke her head with my hand, however timid they may be, and undoubtedly they are extremely so, growling and shouting with their teeth when frightened. They always evince this gentleness and stillness when nursing the little ones. The skin of the young on arrival had the appearance of a slate-coloured kid glove, and the tail darker towards the tip, and the hair could be seen growing black and velvety from the head downwards, and later being hidden in the pouch for some days, and I was interesting to note the progress of the growth of their hair from day to day. The shoulders were covered while the hindquarters were almost or quite bare, although a faint streak of white was discernible where the white markings were to come on later on. At this early stage, should the mother get up to move about, she really does in the daytime, the young somehow scramble into the pouch again. The family later went to the London Society, but the second, which came to me on the 16th of September, I kept for my own pleasure, with the exception for the mother, as she had lost a foot while being trapped. I thought it was best to have her destroyed later on. Unfortunately, when they were about half grown, one escaped into the garden, and the next morning her mutilated remains were found. She had fallen victim of our two fox terriers. Oh, God. Three survivors had ever since an unfailing source of interest and amusement for my family, to visitors and myself. When a bone or a piece of meat was thrown to them, a tug of war was always the result, and sometimes a chase to the door and out to the other little cave. At other times, while the others have been holding on to the bone held by my hand, I have lifted it completely off the ground, while another would cling on round the waist and try to pull it down. Oh yes, many visitors from the Commonwealth have heard of such exaggerated accounts of the ferocity and ugliness of the Tasmanian devils. Others again believe it to be a myth. They sometimes express surprise when they see them so lively, sprightly and excited, running out to my call, and then remark, "The devil is not as black as he is painted." Two of these devils were utterly lately kept together as a pair, and for the purposes of this article, I will call them Billy. Oh, it's beautiful. Beautiful how this book can get you thinking. Oh, it's a beautiful, long tract. One's called Billy, and the other one's called Trogani. after the two survivors of our lost Tasmanian race. Oh, isn't that amazing? These two showed no disposition to breed until April 1913, and my observations of them and many others were that I have had in my keeping is that the disinclination to take up maternal duties is always on the part of the female. I then noticed a sudden decided change, that Billy would not allow her to come out of her little den. If she did venture when she when called to feed, or at other times, he immediately attacked her and would drag her back by the ear or another part. Although otherwise cruel, he would carry food to her. When I called her, it was pitiable to hear her whining, but with no avail, for Billy was a relentless tyrant and kept her strict seclusion for quite 10 to 12 days. Then early in May, he allowed her to feed once more. From thence onwards, although they were sometimes peaceable and affectionate, the balance of power had completely on Targini's side. She constantly resented his approach by biting and snarling at him. It seemed as if coming events cast their shadow before, and she instinctively felt that he would do the young some injury. From now, her pouch was anxiously scanned day by day, but it was some time before I could be sure it was gradually enlarging. I had been advised by Dr. Honley, the New Zealand New York Zoological Park, that if ever tigers and devils were likely to have young, to remove the male as soon as it was certain. I had Billy taken away and placed with the other members of the family. This made Targini most unhappy, as he was near enough for her to hear him, besides which the two males fought. So, being cautioned by the family that perhaps my interference might cause disaster, I yielded and replaced him, doing so with many misgivings. Matters went on very much the same until late September, when to my delight a tail and other times part of a small body could be seen sticking out of the pouch, more especially when she sat up to wash her face or rolled upon her back. Unlike domestic cats, devils use both paws for washing, placing them together and thus making a cup-like depression, which, when thoroughly licked, is rubbed well over the face. Everything looked very promising on Sunday before Middlemass, when I noticed Regina carrying a large bunches of straw around her mouth, evidently seeking for a retired place to make a bed, and we had already placed some fern logs in the corner of her yard. As Billy would follow her about and interfere, I had a box put down and with a hole cut on the side that she might hide under, but it was of no use, as she where she went, he would go, and scrimmage, and was that was the inevitable result. Early next morning, with many misgivings, I left home for 10 days, only to find, on my return, that a pouch was empty and the young had disappeared, and as no remains had been found, I could only conclude they had been eaten by Billy. Thus ended all my hopes of anticipations for 1913. I have not so far related the incident that took place just before the breeding season. Being hopeful that Targini might have had young in her pouch, and my assistant being the very usually very busy Professor Titi Flynn of Tasmanian University, who was always interested in our marsupials, kindly offered to examine her pouch. As soon as he attempted to catch her, Billy grasped the position of affairs and fought to defend her with all his might, even getting behind her in the little cave, putting a paw on each of her shoulders and holding her tightly lest she might get into what appeared to him the danger zone. By dint of perseverance, a little strategy, he was outwitted at last, but our hopes were doomed to disappointment. Targini has now passed through another period of retirement, and I'm hoping to record shortly a greater measure of success in 1914. I cannot close this article without a few words of defence of the Tasmanian devil, so I'm sure that it is more or less misunderstood, and the article with this photograph published in the Royal Magazine, October 1913, under the name of L.J.R. Bridget F.Z., is, I consider, greatly exaggerated both in regard and appearance and the character, viz. They are well named for they tear everything, even sheep, to pieces if they get a chance. On several occasions, when one of mine has escaped, the only mischief done was the destruction of a fowl or a duck or two. it would have been just as easy for a wallaby to have been killed if they had had the inclination, about which our fox terriers would not have hesitated for a minute if the chance had occurred. When in transit to London last year, one escaped. I have been told by the chief officer of the vessel that the passengers would be much alarmed as their children on board and sometimes went about with a revolver. Later, I came across a butcher who was in charge at the time. He appeared to have been rather amused than otherwise, and they told me that missing one was discovered at last sleeping under the berth of one of the sailors. I don't wonder, with the reputation that the devils have, the passengers were alarmed. Mary Roberts had more luck in 1914 when Tacoonie gave birth to three babies. Billy was again the father, but was now kept away from the maternal enclosure. Roberts compiled diary notes as with these examples. 29th, all three playing like puppies, biting each other, pulling another by the ears. 30th, the whole family hanging from the mother, and she ran out. One hardly knows which to admire most, her patience and endurance, or the hardihood of the young holding on to submitting to so much knocking about. The whole process seems very casual and most remarkable. The baby devils had the sense of smell strongly developed. I immediately approached, their nostrils would begin to work, and a vigorously sniffing would go on. They were also expert climbers, and although I had some specially constructed yards made, they would get up the wire netting and walk along the top rail quite easily. At other times, they would climb a pear tree growing in the enclosure and sit on the branches like cats. Her article concludes with a section headed General Remarks. I have always found devils rather fond of a bath. Quite recently, going down to the yard after an illness and finding only a drinking vessel, I ordered a larger one to be put in, and they showed their pleasure by going in at once, sometimes two at a time. I've occasionally poured water into a can over them, and they would run to and fro under it as much as enjoyment. Their sight in daylight is rather defective. They seem to pick up their food more readily by smelling than by seeing, and I think they can see objects better at a distance. At the present time, I had six running together, my own three and three I bought when in my mother's, in their mother's pouch. All are tame, frolicsome and lively. I can go in and have a bit of fun with them, and when I'm outside their enclosure, they frequently climb the wire netting to the height of nearly 6 feet and get their little black faces close to mine with evident delight. We have tried more than once to get them photographed, but it's impossible to keep them quiet. They are on the scamper all the time. Recently, an adult escaped, and it was discovered by a passing schoolboy sitting on a high fence bordering the street under the shade of an elm tree, many people passing on the footpath without observing him. They are, however, always very timid when coming down. They are fond of the sun and look well when basking in it. The rays of shining through make their ears appear bright red, 4 feet parallel to their head, hind quarters quite flat on the ground, turned out at right angles, somewhat like a frog. My sympathy with my little black brothers and sisters is intense, probably evoked by having suffered much mentally owing to the gross cruelties which have come under my notice, the result of catching them in traps. Frequently, three or four have been sent to me in a crate, only to find later on one with a foot shot off or a broken leg. In a consignment received some time ago, a dead one was found. It bore unmistakable signs of a snare previously around its neck. One foot had gone, an old injury, and finally a recent smashed leg, much swollen and cause of death. I communicated with the SPCA, and since they have had none from that district. I have derived much pleasure from studying the habits of the disposition of Tasmanian devils and found that they respond to kindness and certainly show affection and pleasure when I approach them. I have been led to believe that no case of their breeding in captivity has been recorded, and certainly not in Tasmania. Others who do not know or understand them may think of them as they like, but I, who love them and have had considerable experience in keeping most of our marsupials from thylacine down to the opossum mouse, I will always regard them as first favourites, my little black playmates. Well, she's kept Tasmanian tigers. It's amazing that they've gone. Mary Roberts wasn't a trained scientist, but her Balmoral Zoo not only populated native elephants, until then considered loathsome, dangerous, and expendable, it also attracted those few scientists who had begun devoting their energies to understanding and protecting the island's faunas. It's interesting that you wouldn't keep a kangaroo in a zoo because it was vermin. One was Clive Law, director of the Tasmanian Museum, who in 1918 compiled a list of about 50 known descriptions, classifications and drawings of the devils. He expressed concerns that the native species such as the devils were increasing in numbers while very little was known about them. Another was Professor T.T. Theodore Thompson Flynn, who occupies an important place in Australian zoology as a pioneering 20th century mammalogist. His works on the embryology and early development of native animals are rightly... describes as classics. In 1909, he had become the inaugural professor of biology at the University of Tasmania, and for 20 years remained devoted to his research. One of Flynn's early publications, Contribution to the Knowledge of the Anatomy and the Development of the Marsupia, number one, the genitalia or scaphosthenicus, which is the Tasmanian devil. Research derived from a single female devil, the first ever to come into his possession, the Burmese Zoo, but from Clive Lord. In his instructions, Flynn noted that his intention had been to study a number of specimens before publishing his results, but their increased scarcity decided him otherwise. The research himself was obviously not easy, Flynn noting unfortunate lack of original communications and papers in Tasmanian. His introductory notes are illuminating. The specimen of Scaphalus satanicus, his original genital organs, this communication is a description, was forwarded to me through the kind offices of Mr. J.E.C. Lord. This is the only female which I have yet obtained, and I had originally intended that descriptions would wait for further specimens that had come to hand. The increased scarcity, however, of these animals, together with the discovery of a number of interesting significant points in the morphology of the genital organs, has influenced me to publish the results earlier than otherwise would have been the case. Portions of the paper can yet be regarded only as preliminary notes. This is due, in the first place, to the scarcity of material and, in the second, to an unfortunate lack of original communications and papers in Tasmania. His short preparatory descriptions further reveal the difficulties of constructing pioneering scientific work under the conditions he experienced. The specimen is a fully grown female with three fairly advanced young in the pouch. All had been dead for 2 days. They were all dead for 2 days. The pouch young were fixed entire in corrosive sublimate acetic solution. Oh dear. The genital organs of the mother in picrosulfuric solution. In the latter case, on sectioning, it was found that what blood there was in the vessels had hardened so much that it was only with extreme care and difficulty that... So it's not a well devil, is it? That sections could be cut at all. The hopeless grappling of the razor edge and consequent damage to the sections is well indicated in Figure 10. Gulliver provides an interesting snapshot of Flynn and Roberts. Flynn was a very powerful personality, full of drive and energy, which led him to many adventures credible otherwise. He's a fantasist. He was often at the zoo in his early days in Tasmania, but Roberts' diary's entries show declining enthusiasm in August 1918. Mrs. Roberts records that she had set an account to Professor Flynn for the devils, adding that she expected to be paid. Dear, this is amazing. In October 1918, she records that she rang the university RE the skeletons Flynn's has. He was to ring back the next day, but did not do so. Possibly, the non-payment for the specimens may have been the cause of Mrs. Roberts' annoyance with Flynn, but it was not surprising that there was a cooling in their friendship as Mrs. Roberts was fastidiously in all her dealings with Flynn, most casual and unbusinesslike in his. Okay, so A lot of Flynn's adventures were rumoured clandestine sales of thylacines. His family's life was messy, including estrangement from his wife and considerable difficulty in managing his headstrong, wild, sexually charged son, Errol. Oh, that's Professor Flynn. And so now the interesting thing is that my grandmother was Errol Flynn's music teacher. Isn't that amazing? So that's Flynn. Oh, Professor Flynn. Ah. Doesn't become a dashing star for more than 50 Hollywood movies. The first chapter in Errol Flynn's autobiography, called Tasmanian Devils, 1909 to 1927, and it was his Hollywood's, and it was his Hollywood studio, Warner Brothers, that created the irrepressible Looney Tunes character and character, the Tasmanian Devil. Oh, isn't that so beautiful? So it was Errol Flynn, so the father collected devils, and it's amazing. Tasmanian Museum Director Clive Law, in his own writings on Devils Observe, its hardy nature, both in captivity and the wild state, caused one to wonder how it came out that the species became extinct on the mainland within the comparatively recent times. In the roughest section of Tasmania, the species exists in fair numbers, and there's every prospect of it remaining inhabitant in such places for years to come. Lord also sounded what might be called an optimistic warning, one that has still not been resolved for 200 years after George P. Rhodes Harris wrote his description of the devil. Towards the end of his life, Lord wrote, "We, as Australians, have been placed in charge of wonderful heritage, and it rests with us to respond to the trusteeship with that has been granted us." Clive Lord died in 1933, and so official interest in the devil. Isn't that amazing? Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.